boosters. It was about basic augmentation, as if hurrying along evolution to suit the soldiers' tasks. There were other examples, such as a $100,000 battery-powered exoskeleton that helped a man, paralyzed below the waist, walk again, and even finish a marathon, though it took him 20 hours. And a technology called electroencephalography, built into a pair of goggles that could sense signals in the brain associated with the unconscious recognition of danger, a threat warning system that would blend mind with machine to enhance defensive response. "You don't need much of an imagination," the author wrote, "to see that humans will continue to adapt to these technologies by developing ever more sophisticated means of neurological control. The day will then inevitably come when some people have the ability to control such machinery with only their thoughts. The mind becomes a muscle, able to wirelessly interface with objects separate from the body. This is our next leap as humans." The book concluded, "So that several centuries from now, the seeming magic of telekinetics will be reality." Sometimes that made a kind of sense to him. When he felt a headache coming on and a crack reached suddenly across a window. When he took a breath and a candle across the room snuffed out. When he snapped his fingers and a pencil rolled off a desk. Maybe his mind was like the world. Sometimes certain things came together by chance and by fate, like the sparking of electrons, the merging of species, the mutation of a virus, and modified the rules. The thought frightens more than excites him. One day, when he was a teenager, after a group of boys teased him, shoved him around, he came home with a split lip and a pouched blue-black eye and a poisonous sense of self-loathing. One of his cats happened to rub between his legs and then hissed and backed into a corner and curled up on itself and died. He did not understand then what he was capable of. He still isn't sure. Anger, or any heightened emotion, seems to key a lock, help him into a hallway full of dark happenings. So he tries to keep his temper muted. He tries to keep his emotions as gray and blank as stone. He tries to focus his energies on more practical matters, managing the museum, studying history, tinkering with his inventions. But he has been having dreams lately. Dreams about an old man with long white hair and a warm, whispering voice. Dreams about pressing his hand to sand and green grass growing in the shape of it. Dreams about blowing fire from his lungs like a dragon. Dreams about splitting open trees and even mountains by concentrating hard enough. Dreams about, no other word for it, magic. The old man spoke to him in his dreams. He wanted Lewis to stop hiding from himself, embrace the strengths he kept contained. And while these dreams at first made him uneasy, he has come to find them weirdly comforting. As if someone out there regarded him with a paternal kindness. Wished him well. Ever since his hands burned and he hurled Clark, the room brightening with the expended energy, his body has felt achy, his mind slow, as if hungover. He wishes it was all a dream, but he knows better. He still feels in a dream now as he stands in the museum's sunroom, the largest of its galleries, a high-ceilinged space with tall, rounded windows running the length of it. He is holding the rib of a stegosaurus in his hand, the long, sharp curve of it, like a yellowed scimitar. He rotates the exhibits every month. The rise of Egypt, the fall of Rome, the space race, the great American West. For the past 2 days, with the help of Ella, his aide, he has been building dioramas, bolting together bones, hanging posters, readying one of their most popular displays, When Dinosaurs Ruled. Whenever people walk through the museum to study their enormous skulls, their spiked teeth, their rib cages like baskets big enough for several men to fit inside, they seem in disbelief that something so fierce and powerful could be wiped out so easily. From there, he knows, it doesn't take much imagination to recognize that at any moment something can come blazing out of the sky and change everything. He hears a voice. Ella's. She's saying his name, as if it were a curse. She stands on a stool and wrenches a bolt into place that will secure a section of vertebrae.
You aren't listening to me?
Apparently not. I've asked 3 times whether this stage will be labeled Cretaceous or Jurassic. He rubs a hand across his face. I am not myself.
If you would simply sleep, like a normal person would, like I tell you to regularly, maybe this wouldn't be an issue.
When she speaks, she punctuates her sentences with the wrench, jabbing it in the air as if to knock him about with it. You're right.
8 hours, that's what I get, and I feel great.
She brings the wrench to her temple.
My mind is sharp. My body is healthy, unlike yours.
Yes, I'll try that. 8 hours. The museum is a sacred space, a cathedral sought out in dark times. People hush their voices and remove their hats when they walk through it. They close their eyes and lower their heads before the exhibits. Lewis knows he makes people uncomfortable, just as people make him uncomfortable, so he remains hidden away in his study during their open hours. Ella has become the public face of the museum. She watches over it, answers any questions people might have when they retreat here. The space is shadowy and cool, orderly and manicured, full of polished treasures. It is everything the sanctuary is not. Its celebration of the long, difficult novel of humanity, the individual stories that make up the larger story of civilization, gives people hope, purpose. Others have endured, and so will they. But today, it is empty, because everyone is at the stadium. Lewis told Thomas not to do it, begged him not to sentence the girl to a public death, and on what grounds? Terrorism. That was what Thomas told everyone. 2 decades ago, 2 rangers had gone missing, believed dead, though in fact they had abandoned the sanctuary. Somehow, all this time, they managed to survive on their own. This girl, their daughter, had come hoping to lure others out, to breach the wall and risk all their lives. It was an act of terrorism. She was a terrorist. Lewis said, "Everyone will recognize that as a lie."
"Fear beats logic every time," Thomas said. "You'll see. Everyone will be screaming for her blood."
"She's a child."
"What's the average lifespan around here? 30? 40? She's practically middle-aged."
This was yesterday in the dome, where they met in a first-floor sitting room. Thomas lounged in a wingback chair while Lewis stood. He refused the offer of a seat, refused a plate of spiced grasshoppers, refused even a smoke. "Let me speak to her. Please." Thomas wore snakeskin boots and fondled a thin wooden pipe. He tamped a pinch of tobacco and sparked a match and brought the flame to the bowl and puffed until it glowed orange and smoke tusked from his nose.
"How does this have anything to do with you?"
"If there are indeed outlying communities, we need to reach out to them." Thomas made an encompassing gesture with the pipe.
"Do you know what has kept people alive all these years? They believe. They believe in the wall."
His voice was quiet, but Lewis knew this was how he yelled. Smoke swirled like a storm taking form.
"What you're talking about would threaten everything we've built here."
"Their faith has already evaporated like all the water in the world."
"The rains will come. They always do."
They always had, this was true. But it had been so long. Months now, that rain felt like a barely remembered dream. The same as his election promises. More than a year ago, when he took office, he promised he would rebuild the crumbling sections of the city. He would rid crime from the Fourth Ward. He would expand the gardens. He would drill a new well and repair those broken. He would make every citizen live up to their potential, live their best life, evolve, whatever that meant, and so on. None of it true. And, with the wells failing and the storage tanks emptying, the weather felt like a punishment, like a reprimand for his election. The round reaches of the sky, a magnifying lens that sharpened the sun that would crisp them to death. For a moment, Lewis considered telling Thomas about the letter, sharing its secrets, but only for a moment. In case Clark should actually make good on her promise and depart the sanctuary, Thomas should know as little as possible about where she is headed. "I would like to speak to her. Before you do what you're planning to do.
No, I don't think so.
He sucked at the pipe, and it sizzled with his breath.
But if you give me what I've been asking for, if you give me my guns,
I'll consider
letting you speak to her.
No.
Thomas rose from his chair then. Even in his boots, he was a head shorter than Lewis, but somehow he made himself seem bigger in the way of a petulant child, his pale face growing red as he approached Lewis. He held out his pipe like a weapon, and Lewis backed away until he could retreat no farther. Thomas leaned in so that his smoking breath made a hot wind on Lewis's face, and he choked on the taste.
Do you know what I can do to you? I can do anything I want to you.
You're threatening me again?
I'm telling you the way things are, old friend.
The streets are empty, except for dogs lounging in shadows, dust devils that die as they take shape. The wind carries the creak of the turbines and the distant cheers and whistles from the stadium. In an alleyway, a figure appears, a woman dressed in the black uniform of the deputies, surveying the street before darting across it like the shadow of a crow. It takes only a moment for her, her face obscured by a black hat and neckerchief, to scale the wall of the museum and slip through an open window. She pauses in the half-light, her eyes adjusting, taking in her surroundings, an interactive exhibit featuring the games of another era. There are chess and checkerboards, tables strewn with playing cards, and a jigsaw puzzle that comes together into a pot of gold at the end of a rainbow. Bins full of balls and bats and rackets and mallets, game consoles with slits in their sides, and wires tentacling out of them. She slips out of the room and into a hallway festooned with suits of armor from various ages and regions, some clad in reeds, others in metal, before climbing the stairs, fast but not so fast as to clomp her boots or whine a floorboard, every step a whisper. She glances over her shoulder, often, and sticks to the shadows. Here, at the center of the museum, the building rises into a square tower, its highest story consisting of Lewis's office and living quarters. She pauses on the landing with her head cocked, and then peers over the railing, back the way she came. Voices swirl faintly upward, Lewis and his aide, their voices sharp and bullying, but distant. She seems confident she is alone now, as she starts down the hall, and knobs open the door to a room that remains as dim as twilight. The floor is a mess of books, the windows are curtained off, and the sheets of one bed are tidily made, squared and tucked beneath their mattress. The sheets of the other hold down an old woman who smells of lavender and rot and urine, who observes the approaching black-clad figure with one bulging eye. When the figure hovers over her a second before gently pressing a pillow to her face, she does not struggle, except to lift a hand, let it shiver, and fall. The owl observes all of this from the night table, its glass eyes trained on the figure, who remains hunched over the bed for a long time, long enough for her arms to quake, for her legs to collapse so that she kneels beside the bed as if overcome by a terrible prayer. A lamp on the wall sputters and emits a dim, brown glow. Before it can brighten fully, she wobbles upright and stumbles from the room, and in doing so, trips over a stack of books and knocks into the bureau, and then the door, as if lost in some dark place, uncertain where she is. Lewis and Ella are struggling up the stairs with a femur the size of a log. They have rested several times on their way up from the basement, and he has stumbled twice and nearly lost his grip. She is cursing him all the way, asking why they cannot wait, why this has to happen now. Normally they seek help from one of their custodians or guards, but the museum is closed and everyone is away, no one wanting to miss the execution. Lewis lives most often in a state of poised stillness, seated at his desk, bent over a book. He has never been interested in any sort of exercise, but these past few days, ever since he hurled Clark against the pillar, he has felt a restlessness that needs some outlet. He doesn't know if it is the lingering sense of power, the humming at his fingertips as if they were orange-hot blades struck on an anvil, or the possibility of escape,
stealing past the wall, exploring landscapes that he previously believed would exist for him only on paper and in dreams. But he cannot sit still. He cannot stop pacing, tidying. He desires movement. He and Ella rest again when they reach the landing, setting down the femur with a thump. She wears the outfit of a boy, short pants, short-sleeved shirt with a leather vest. Her hair is damp with sweat plastered to her forehead. "I'm sitting on this thing, whether you like it or not," she says, and collapses onto the bone, a yellow-brown bench with hairline fissures running through it. The cracks in it are like the cracks in everything. Cracks in concrete, cracks in rubber and asphalt and glass, cracks in faces ruined by the sun. Nothing is new. Above them rises the bowl of a rotunda, one of two in the museum, each bearing a fresco, the sky by day, the sky by night. Theirs is the night, star-spangled and moonlit. Lewis would love to reach for the silver canister inside his pocket, shove his nose into it, snort his way into a numb, pleasant dream. But he has heard enough scolding from Ella this afternoon. He pushes his fists into the small of his back and stares upward. He breathes heavily and says between breaths, "I would love to walk on the moon." Before he finishes the sentence, he hears his echo, the ghost of his voice, whispering back. Ella glances up as if she might spot another version of Lewis hovering above them. Then she looks at him, smiles, until dimples pocket her cheeks. "Say something," he says. "See if it comes back to you." She leans back her head, her mouth open and ready to call out when, from somewhere upstairs, comes a distant sound, a slam and groan, like something heavy shoved across the floor. Then, the patter of footsteps. The two of them look at each other, startled, before pursuing the sound source, taking the stairs, two at a time. Chapter 5. The sanctuary's founders deliberately signed their constitution on July 4th. They hoped to at once borrow and revise the sentiment of nationhood. They were America, a miniature version, living off hope, waiting for help, but America nonetheless. For a long time this worked. On what came to be known as Resurrection Day, people painted black circles beneath their eyes the night before to indicate sickness, and washed them away the next morning to signify health. Gifts were exchanged. A costume parade full of dancing skeletons marched through the city, ending at the stadium, where so many years ago men pulled on padded armor and crashed into each other while chasing a football, where the faded murals of the St. Louis Rams still adorn the pocked concrete tunnels and walls that surround the field, and where the citizens of the sanctuary drank and feasted and danced. The mayor always rode at the back of the parade, as Thomas does now, wearing a bone crown on a bone chair atop a horse-drawn wagon decorated with clattering bones. He waves at the people who fill the sidewalks, but no one waves back. They watch him with what can only be fear and distaste. His waving slows, then stops altogether, along with his smile, and he tells the driver to hurry up already. His eyes dart about, as if he is worried something might be hurled at him. Today, before the Resurrection Day feast, the rider will be killed. Many, including Lewis, including the city council, have asked Thomas not to do so. He would spoil the fun, they said. Ruin the holiday mood. People need something to celebrate. If he insisted on killing the girl, why not drag her out the gates and chain her to the altar like everyone else? "Because she comes from out there," Thomas said. "So she must be punished in here." Here, too, he has a captive audience. He wants to put an end to the graffiti, to the effigies, to the underground mutterings of whatever faction is out to ruin his time in office. At the stadium, he will force people to see what he wants them to see, a demonstration of his power. The synthetic dome that once covered the stadium was long ago torn away and salvaged, so the sun beats down this July 4th on the many seated now in the lower deck, more than 20,000 bodies, all shading their eyes and squinting painfully. Everyone studies the four black-mouthed tunnels at the corners of the field. Their voices begin as a hesitant mutter that rises into a charged hum the longer they wait. Energy emanates from them like waves of heat, some combination of loathing and confusion and excitement for what they are about to witness. Afterward, there will be music and food. There is that, at least. Not like the feasts of the old days, but something. All around the stadium hang flags. Thomas's flag, with the single star burning brightly at the center. There is a spattering of applause when the mayor and his wife take their place high among them, along with several deputies, servants, and members of the city council, at midfield, in a boxed-off suite with an open window from which they wave. Her name is Danica. She looks like a piece of jewelry, she knows. Another ornament for the mayor. If he is deserving of her attention, he is deserving of theirs, the logic goes. Her hair is so blonde, it appears white. From a distance, people find her beautiful. But up close, there is something unnerving about her appearance. Her many sharp angles, her collarbone, her thin lips, her chiseled jaw, her sharp fingers, make her appear like something that can cut through its own clothes, shred its own skin. And though she keeps them hidden in her shoes, her toes are strangely extended, good for gripping. Pants are all anyone seems to wear anymore, but she never appears in public without a dress. This one, white linen, and already brown along the hem from the dust she cannot escape. She wears a gold chain around her neck that matches her gold belt, her waist as wide around as her husband's thigh. Sometimes he calls her his lovely bone. Thomas drops into a seat and brushes the powdery dust from its armrests. A servant brings him a plate stacked high with dates, wrinkled like ugly little heads. "Oh," he says, "this is just what I wanted." She prefers to stand and shakes her head stiffly when offered a seat beside him. The day before, Clark sought out her brother, York. He was easy to find, a street performer who tumbled and juggled and blew fire and swallowed swords. He could send cards in a riffling arc from one hand to the other. He could lose a coin from his palm and find it in the mouth of another. He could sing 1,000 songs and tell 1,000 stories. She needed only to look for a crowd, a flurry of applause, and there he was, entertaining the long line of people waiting to fill their jug at the well. Clark's father died, like so many died, of cancer. A purple blotch swelled on his nose and spilled across his cheek. A melanoma the doctors cut away, leaving a hole in his face, too late. He lost weight suddenly, lost his balance regularly, and soon began to lose his mind when the tumors took seed in his brain. Her mother did not marry again, but a decade later became pregnant with York. He was Clark's half-brother, but felt more like a son, as her mother died not much later, so blotched with melanomas she appeared splattered with some foul wine. The sun would kill them all, it sometimes seemed. From a distance, for a few minutes, she watched him perform. He dipped daggers in linseed oil and set them on fire and tossed them in flaming ellipses. He was bareheaded so that people could see his face and so that he could see his daggers. His arms were a blur. His forehead was beaded with sweat, his smile so wide it reached his ears. His hands were too square and meaty for his arms, and his lean neck bunched into a fist of an Adam's apple. She had tried to enlist him as a sentinel, but he resisted.
"I don't want another boss," he said, "when I've already got you."
She couldn't lay off him. She tried, really tried, but couldn't resist swatting the back of his head, bullying him with her words every time he made a foolish decision. They shared the same blood. He was hers, that's how she felt, like a hand or tooth. By taking care of him, she was taking care of herself. He wanted to make people smile, give them some small escape, always goofing, whereas she was always serious. These days, most everyone is some shade of brown, but people still smile when the two of them stand beside each other as siblings, with his nut-colored skin and her fiery hair and freckled face. She waited for him to catch the daggers, one, two, three, and extinguish them each in his mouth. waited for the applause and the coins people tossed his way, before approaching him and tugging his sleeve and saying they needed to talk.
A Valent?
He had a gap between his teeth he showed often in a smile. About the kind of thing that can get us killed. He packed his bag and swung it over his shoulder and blew kisses to three young girls before following Clark from the square. She said, "You're performing at Resurrection Day?"
"Yeah, but they want something different now, not just for the feast, but before, too. Warm up the crowd before the execution."
"Even better."
"What's going on?"
He nudged her with his elbow.
"Are we making a move? Is this it?"
They entered an alley, and its tight walls clapped away at the sun. In shadow, they walked, and she whispered, "Consider this your final performance." In the stadium, hundreds of tables had been arranged into four squares, with two wide corridors splitting the space between them in the shape of a cross. At the center of the cross rises a freshly constructed gallows, with a noose dangling from it that casts an eyelit shadow. The body will dangle there through the meal to follow, when people file from the bleachers to their seats and a band strikes up a merry tune. York races out of a tunnel and along one of these corridors. A ripple of applause works its way through the crowd. He cartwheels and tumbles and finally pounds his way up the gallows and swings from its noose and then spins in a circle to survey his audience. From his pants pocket, he withdraws what looks like a black rope that he keeps pulling and pulling and pulling and pulling and then snaps like a whip. It unfurls then, ripples in the wind, opens up into a massive silk scarf, maybe 20 feet long and half as wide. He begins to manipulate its form, bunching it first into a storm cloud that dots the ground with rain. Then his hands slash and twist when he knots it into the shape of a giant raven. It caws and pecks at his hand before taking flight and fluttering one way and then another. His lips seem not to move when it calls out in its croaking way. Then he snaps the scarf, and it unrolls to its full length, and he twists it into a rope, what appears to be a snake curling along the stage before coiling up at his feet. Again, he reaches for his pocket. This time he produces a red stone, a blue stone, an orange stone. He transfers the stones one by one to his opposite hand until they fill his palm like a cluster of fruit. He shoots them into the air, spinning them upward in a colored blur. The stones rise higher and higher, ridiculously high, until they might scrape the sky. He adds to their rotation an apple he takes intermittent bites of, and the crowd erupts, crying out with pleasure, crashing their hands together in applause. York can't seem to help it. He smiles so widely his eyes vanish into folds, and then the smile vanishes, and the apple core falls to the ground, and the stones fall and clatter into his pocket, blue, orange, red, when the girl is escorted onto the field. No one screams, or boos, or stomps their feet. Instead, the stadium plunges into silence. Her wrists are bound, and she is led by two deputies who hold her by the elbows. Her face is puffed with bruises. She wears a scarf of bandages. Whether she is limping or resisting the deputies, it is unclear, but they drag and support her. From her midfield suite, high above the rest of the crowd, the silence is such that Danica can hear the scraping echoes of their footsteps. A trail of dust rises behind them and ghosts away with the wind. When the girl arrives at midfield, some of the people in the stands begin to yell, their voices swelling, some pitched high, some low, the many layers of sound eventually merging into one sustained note that seems to shake the air. Whether they are calling out questions, or calling for mercy, or calling for blood, it is hard to tell. The girl appears so thin, like a piece of wood somebody whittled and gave up on, though there remains something strangely vibrant about her. Her skin has an earthen richness. Her hair is the same black as the vultures that spin in the sky. Her posture is unyielding, despite her circumstances. Danica watches her with a grim curiosity when the deputies lead her up the steps of the gallows to the platform. The people in the stands watch, too, whether hopefully judgmentally, Danica doesn't know. But when the girl turns in a slow circle and tries to meet their gaze, they drop their faces and go silent, as if frightened her dark eyes alone might carry some contagion. Vultures tornado the sky, and she stands among the black, swirling color of their shadows. She looks as if she might say something, but the injury to her throat prevents it. Then the deputies fit the noose around her neck, and Thomas stands up to cheer and clap his hands. He swings his arms so wildly that he knocks an elbow into Danica, and she staggers a few steps. As she does, she looks to the doorway behind her, where Reed stands. He nods at her. She runs her hands along her dress, straightening out the wrinkles. She leans in to her husband and tells him she feels ill. She will see him later.
What?
He says. Then, oh,
fine.
Not even bothering to look at her, his eyes on the field, his hands still clapping sharply together. She follows Reed at a distance, down a staircase, along a concrete corridor with rusted pipes veining its ceiling. He slips through a door and she is not far behind him. Light streams from a single window. The air smells of metal and leather and oil. The deputies use these rooms for storage. Bows hang from hooks on the walls. Knives and bats and arrows lie strewn across a table that runs the length of the room. Just as she enters, Reed shuts the door behind her and presses her against it. What they are doing is kissing, though it looks much like eating. Their mouths opening and closing hungrily, their teeth biting down on lips, cheeks. When they pull apart, their faces are a splotchy red, and he is bleeding from the corner of his mouth. What have you learned? She says.
They're going to do it. They're going to leave. They're making every preparation.
They. Don't try to separate yourself from them.
We, then. We're going to do it.
Are you?
You can come. You should. You must.
Are you still fucking that woman? He gapes at her, his hesitation all the answer she needs. I thought so, she says.
I don't feel about her the same way I do you.
Is that right? She's just someone to fuck.
I love you. I do. And I want you to come with me.
That's nice of you.
We've been waiting for the right moment. It's here. We've been talking about this for a long time. Now is the time.
We've been talking. Yes.
Doing is something else entirely.
We're trying to get Lewis Merriweather to join us. She snorts through a smile. Why do you keep bringing him up?
What use is he? He knows more about the outside world than anyone else. He knows more about everything than anyone else.
He knows paper. He doesn't know blood. Or dirt, or sweat. Besides that, he has the fortitude of a sick child.
I wouldn't be so sure of that. There are things about him that would surprise you.
Please. You're not fool enough to believe in what people say about him. Lewis, the eater of children, the binder of spells, the freak in the Dark Tower.
I might be.
She runs a hand along his beard, then pinches a whisker and rips it out. He flinches. And she shoves him aside and walks to the table at the center of the room. So, you're suggesting that we uproot, say goodbye to all we have built here, on the word of one girl.
If it's true, if what she says is true, the country there is rich.
If it's true. Is there any future here?
Really?
Her back is to him, but she can hear him slide closer to her. Can feel his breath at her neck.
What does your husband say?
Do we really need to talk about him? She picks up a dagger, black handle, black blade, and runs her finger along its edge. He says it's not true. Of course he says that. And he says, even if any of it is true, no good can come of it, and we must put it behind us. The more people know, the less sure they will be of everything. That's what he says.
Look at it this way.
Even if we stay here, this is a chance to trade, to open lines of communication, to unite, maybe even make a kind of country. How patriotic of you. She turns around and prods his belt with the knife. The other possibility is that this is all a pipe dream.
I'd like to believe it's true. We've got to believe in something.
She drops the dagger on the table and reaches her hands around his neck, massages him until his head lolls with her fingertips.
Relax, she whispers. Relax.
His eyes shutter closed with her rubbing.
This could be a chance for us to start over, too.
Her tongue darts from her mouth and wets her lips.
Enough talking.
She releases him and turns around and lifts up her dress until it bunches around her waist and leans over the table stacked with steel.
Hurry up and take me.
The black-clad figure races the streets, cutting through alleys, breathing in panicked gulps, before finally collapsing in a shadowed alley. The neckerchief peels away to reveal a face. Clark's, just in time for her to vomit freely. She throws her hat aside. Her hair has come loose from her ponytail. Her stomach clenches and empties. With a line of spit hanging from her lips, she cries out with inarticulate shame and fury. Out of the cracks come several scuttling beetles, joined by a black-winged butterfly to drink from the mess she has left for them. She roughs her mouth across her wrist. There was a time when she found herself often in this position, hunched over, her throat surging, yesterday's meal flecking her lips, and a bottle full of tequila puddling the ground between her feet. She couldn't stop herself. One drink always became 10 drinks. And she would end every night swinging a fist or falling into bed with someone she couldn't remember in the morning. She didn't have any sort of excuse. Drinking was a way to antidote the boredom, the sense of purposelessness. Drinking was a way to numb the anger she always felt coiling inside her. Maybe. But in the end, she believed it came down to the sort of person she was, a woman of great appetites. Soon, she will leave this place, and when she leaves, she will have escaped her old self, the old Clark. She will be able, they all will be able, to begin again. Lewis's mother is dead, but she was already dead, a ruined vessel no different from the city presently rotting around her. Clark was doing her a favor. She was doing Lewis a favor. I am trying, she thinks. I am trying to make things better, trying to help, but she knows that the murder... No, the death, that's a better way to think of it. The death of the old woman will weigh on her chest like a cold stone. For the moment, though, she need only worry about Lewis. More than once in her life, she has witnessed the unexplainable. A storm of dead crows raining from the sky. A plant, like a long green finger, that came twisting out of the ground when she spilled water from her canteen. The man with the parasite that grew so massive inside him that his belly distended and shifted as if from some alien pregnancy. The seers in the market who could read your past and future in your palm, in tea leaves, in the squiggly purple guts of rats. But never anything like the other night. People have always spoken of Lewis as if he were and were not human. He has always struck her as a kind of weak phantom, a shade of a man. But it was not until he hurled her back against the pillar, not until she suffered against what felt like a giant, fiery pair of hands, that she understood what he was capable of, and why they needed him on their side more than ever. She knows, everyone knows, of his difficult history with the mayor. She knows about Thomas badgering him for guns and black powder. She came to the museum costumed as a deputy and made certain the owl observed her clearly. She is counting on his mutiny. But if Lewis discovers it was her, and who knows what he can see, then she knows her guilt over smothering an old woman will be the least of her troubles. She rises to her feet and spits and takes a deep, calming breath. Over the years, she has found ways to keep her temper in check, to breathe in through her nose, out through her mouth, to sketch out words on her palm with a fingernail. Hate. Mad. Fuck. Die. This helps settle her now, to loosen her coiled sense of confusion and loathing as she races through the maze of streets. She needs to hurry. If everything has gone according to plan, if her brother has done as she asked him to do, then they won't have much time. When York first climbs the gallows and swings from its noose, he uses a razor tucked in his palm to thin the rope to a few threads.
Then the deputies march across the field, dragging the girl between them, and York descends the steps, and momentarily loses his focus. In part, it is her eyes, like polished balls of obsidian. But more than that, it is her. The oval cut of her face, the regal way she holds her head. In her own way, she is beautiful. He stares at her dumbly until they march her up the 13 steps of the gallows. Then he shakes off his trance and positions himself below, waiting for the trap door to open. In his head, he has rehearsed their escape so many times that it already seems a reality. There are 4 tunnels in the stadium, each as black as a skull's sockets. Down one of them waits the mass of caterers and musicians who will take to the field following the execution. Down another tunnel huddle a few deputies, though most of them patrol the bleachers. The other 2 tunnels are unoccupied, the corridors to the south side of the stadium strewn with sand and half-collapsed. York has scouted them, picked the lock of a side door, stowed weapons and clothes in a nearby alley. The streets will be empty when he and the girl race to meet Clark. But that's not what happens. The deputies fit the noose around her neck, and she looks to the sky as if in prayer. Her black eyes reflect the white-blue expanse swarming with vultures. Her body goes rigid, and York hears something then, though he cannot place the sound so much as he can feel the attendant shiver, the air like struck tin. Vultures always swoop over the sanctuary, but they come together now by the hundreds, more and more of them drawn from rooftops and thermals, coalescing into a spinning black funnel with the gallows as its axis. The crowd follows her gaze upward. They murmur and shrink in their seats as if they can sense what's coming. And then it comes. The cyclone collapses, and all at once the vultures fall on the stadium. They are a terrible rain, but not the one everyone has been praying for. Big balls of air come rolling off their long-fingered wings, making a wind strong enough to raise dust devils all over the field. People squint their eyes and throw up their hands and cry out in voices that match the scratchy timbre of the vultures. Some of the birds land on shoulders, and some of them swing by as if on wires. Their claws slash, their bald red heads dart in for a bite. 4 of them dive the gallows. Their wings are as wide as a man is tall and so black that the sunlit air seems striped by midnight. The deputies do not have time to reach for their machetes. They barely have time to hold up their hands. One of the men reels back and falls from the 10-foot platform. The ground meets his back with a meaty thud that knocks the air from his lungs and leaves him momentarily paralyzed, too stunned to lift his arms and ward off the vulture that swoops onto his chest. The other deputy, with a vulture pinned to his shoulder, his face cowled by its wings, falls onto the lever that opens the trap door. By this time, York has ducked beneath the platform, out of the sun, into shadow, away from the birds that sweep and dagger the air. So when the trap door swings open, when a square of light appears above him, when a body tumbles through it, when the noose catches and snaps, he throws out his arms and snatches her from the air. They don't have time to pause, but for a moment his body stiffens, arrested by the sight of her in his arms. Her expression is flat, and her eyes give him nothing back, not hate, or gratitude, or fear. So he feels compelled to say something. "Hi." And then, "I'm here to help." Something softens in her face, and he feels relieved, as if from the pressure of a knife. She might fit easily into his arms, but she could hurt him if she wanted to. Impossible as it may seem, she is responsible for the vultures. He doesn't know how he knows this, but he does, and he accepts it with the awe of a child who watches a magician spit fire and spring bouquets from ears. The crowd is still screaming, and the vultures are still plunging when he puts her down and she slips the noose off her neck and grabs his hand and runs for the south tunnel. He finds himself hurrying after her, even though he is the one who should be yelling, "Follow me." Chapter 6. Most of the sentinels live in a stucco building with shuttered windows next to the stables. There is a kitchen and latrine and common room on the ground floor, apartments on the upper 3 levels. Clark keys open her door, and can barely shove her way inside, the floor so cluttered with rank piles of clothes and the named and unnamed objects she has salvaged from the Deadlands. A broken blue mug, a golf club, a faded red can of Coca-Cola, a typewriter with rows of gleaming yellow teeth, a snow globe with a white-bearded, red-suited Santa inside it. As soon as she closes the door behind her, she begins to strip, tearing off the deputy's uniform and stuffing it beneath her bed. On the wall hangs a cracked mirror, mossy and veined with age, and she studies her reflection in it, her body pale, her face and hands rough and sunburned. Then she picks up some clothes from the floor and smells them before pulling them on. Her brother is safe. The girl is safe. For now. Deputies will gather. They will march the streets and knock on doors and overturn closets and pantries and basements and attics, and they will make black X's on a map for the places they have already visited. Not only will the mayor appear a fool for losing the girl, he will appear a cruel god for upending every drawer in the sanctuary in pursuit of her. Clark will be questioned once, within the next hour or so, she guesses, and Reed will vouch for her and her loyal service as a sentinel. A few days later, when the deputies seek her out again, she won't be around for them to find. Her mind vibrates, her guts feel feathery. She makes her hands into fists and presses them to her eyes. She could use a drink. Terribly. A few weeks ago, she promised Reed she would stop. Just like that. Like a door had closed, bolted. She relapsed once, the other day, after the death parade. She does not get quivery when she passes a bar, when she sees people drinking or smells liquor on their breath. But the real trouble comes at night. She dreams of drinking. Glass after glass, gallons of whatever is being poured, bathing herself in it. And when she drinks in her dreams, her knees do not wobble, her words do not slur. Instead, she's happy, unafraid. This feeling, a good feeling, warm and expansive, carries over when she wakes, feeling drunken, the world slippery around the edges. And sometimes it is an hour and two cups of tea later before she can shake it. Now, as she lies back on her bunk, staring at the ceiling, her mind is drifting. Her hand is reaching for a bottle that isn't there. When the door opens and Reed steps through it, she rushes out of bed and takes the back of his head and shoves her face against his and drinks deeply of him until he pushes her back with a confused laugh. "Okay," he says. "Okay, I assume this means everything worked out? They're safe?" "They're safe." She still holds him by the head, his braid wrapped in her fist. "You smell funny. And you taste like bile. Want to trade more love poems?" "You do. You smell." Her eyes sparkle angrily. "You smell like some flower." "Forget about it. I sat next to some reeking woman at the stadium." "What woman? Her? You said you were done with—" "I said forget about it." He pushes her hair back from her forehead and kisses it. "What happened with Lewis?" She releases him and falls back into bed and forces her head into the pillow as if to suffocate the words. "It's done. She's dead." Lewis is not the only body in his bedchamber, but he is very much alone. He kneels over his mother in much the same posture as the one who murdered her. Her face is a ghastly rictus of pain. He draws back the sheet to reveal the slim length of her, like a bundle of sticks. He does not cry. He cannot remember the last time he cried. He doesn't know if he's capable of it. But he embraces her, drawing her body toward him so that it arches, her head lolling painfully back. He holds her like this for a long time. And while he holds her, the night gathers outside and deputies shout in the streets and the room flickers with light as the owl projects over and over again the grainy image of the deputy smothering her. As expected, the deputies come for Clark. They ask about her brother, and she says, half-brother. They ask if she has seen him, and she says, "I throw him some coin if I see him performing, but we don't talk much. Not anymore."
She denies any knowledge of his whereabouts, expresses her disgust and astonishment, and says she will be the first to let them know if he comes crawling to her. Then she excuses herself. I have to work. She paces the wall all through the night as a sentry. And now it is dawn, and her eyes buzz with exhaustion, and with the competing thoughts that bump around inside her head like bees in a jar. The possibility that she may escape. The possibility that she may not. That she may spend the rest of her life caught in this globe, like the one she salvaged from the Deadlands, with sand instead of snow churning through it. She tries to concentrate on her hands and feet, finding a good grip on the ladder, the strips of rebar cemented into the wall. But even now her mind wanders, her hands curling around metal in much the same way they curled around the corners of the pillow, pressed down on the old woman's gaping face. The sky is pinkening, the first bell ringing, the sanctuary coming alive around her, when she drops onto the roof of an ancient school bus, then its hood, then the ground. A halo of dust rises around her. The faded, sandblasted black letters of St. Louis Public Schools still reach the bus's length, but it has no wheels, the undercarriage sunken into the dirt like a wallowing beast. Its occupants stir awake. They tear aside the rags hanging in the windows and curse her for waking them. In response, she fights a yawn. There are many farms in the sanctuary, all of them guarded and gated off, and though she isn't supposed to, she cuts through one of them now, climbing and jumping the iron-spiked fence, hurrying her way home. One of the sewage canals is diverted through the quarter acre, its many small channels oozing and buzzing with flies. She tromps past a raised box of sweet potatoes, another clustered with beans, another spiked with corn, others with barley, wheat. The dirt is dusted with bone meal and moistened with sewage, some cocktail of nitrogen and phosphate to increase yields. Several gardeners wander around, irrigating and harvesting. One of them asks if she thinks she can do whatever she wants, and she says, "Pretty much," before climbing the fence and dropping down on the other side. She walks down a tight, shadowy street, so tired that at first she isn't sure she hears what she thinks she hears. A whisper. Her name. But when she turns, she sees the man standing 20 yards behind her. The wind tunnels through this cement corridor and knocks his gray duster back to reveal the thinness of his figure. Lewis. He is far enough away, and the wind gusting enough, that she cannot be certain how his whisper carried so far, as if he tossed his voice like a ball through the air. Come. She feels her face redden with a rush of blood, her guilt announcing itself. She cannot find her voice at first, but manages to strangle out a question. What do you want? He says nothing, only stares at her with those cold blue eyes, before turning, his duster snapping grayly behind him like a spectral hand, beckoning her. She follows him, not knowing what he knows, not wanting to know. Everything hangs in the balance, as if poised at the edge of a great chasm, and she feels at once ebullient and fearful. She does not notice the street unscrolling beneath her feet until she finds herself in Old Town and climbing the steps of the museum. They seem to shake, but it is she. She is shaking. He does not hold the door for her, and he does not pause once they enter, but continues forward without looking back, gliding through the entry with the golden compass emblazoned on the floor and continuing to a circular stone staircase that, from the landing, seems to wind down into tighter and tighter circles, like the inside of a shell. "Where is the girl?" he says. "Safe. There are only so many places to hide." "They won't find her. I can promise you that. People are saying she called the birds down from the sky." "That's what they're saying." "I need to talk to her. Only one way that's happening." They descend 3 stories. At every landing, there is a doorway, and beside every doorway, a lantern. By the time they enter the basement, shadow overpopulates light. Lewis tries a switch, but the bulb above them explodes with a spray of sparks. So he unhooks the entryway lantern and holds it ahead of him as he walks. She follows in her own private darkness, while ahead he seems to float in a sputtering orange light that reveals the half-seen shapes of their surroundings, hallways that elbow into rooms full of shrouded paintings, glass-cased moths with eyes patterned on their wings, a harp with cobwebbed strings, a dust-clotted tiger with a raised paw and a snarl frozen on its face, stacked high all around them, sometimes with only a narrow corridor between. She rams her knee into a crate, and six cockroaches come scuttling out from beneath it. Lewis continues to creep along before her, his back hunched and bony. There is a smothering, airless feeling down here, and it is easy to imagine the light extinguished, the darkness collapsing all around her. It is easy to imagine Lewis pinning her to a velvet board like one of his moths, making her a part of this vast, rotting collection. Then he is standing before a giant American flag, a real one, not the mayor's single-starred version, its stars and stripes stained and faded and untwining along the edges. He tears it away from the wall. They both cough at the dust that swarms the air and sleeves their throats, and when she calms her breathing, she notices the wooden door with the iron ring Lewis takes in his hand. The wood has warped, and the door has not been opened in many years, so Lewis must heave three times to expose even a thin black gap. He sets the lantern on the floor and takes the ring now with two hands, and at last the door opens with a groaning complaint. The faint tang of oil breathes from the closet. Lewis holds the lantern into the space to battle back the shadows, and it takes Clark a moment to understand what she is looking at. She recognizes them from books, from paintings and photographs. An arsenal of pistols and rifles, black-barreled with wooden and plastic grips, dozens of them neatly stacked on floor-to-ceiling shelves. Are those? Yes. He clears his throat. I'm not sure what else you have in the way of supplies, but we'll need stores of water, especially, and what does this mean? She's trying to read something in his face, doubting what he has shown her, doubting him. He does not appear excited or afraid, his expression resigned to a hard frown. It means I'll go. His face tightens and untightens. He speaks so quietly, as if he barely believes the words. I'll go. She is not the type to cry, but right then, she feels a tear slip from her eye and down her cheek. But first, there's one more thing you need to know. With that said, he reaches up his sleeve and pulls from it a letter. It concerns the girl. Chapter 7. No one knows where the flu came from. Some say a long black car pulled up to a gas station, and from it stepped a black-haired man in a black suit, coughed once into his fist, and gripped the pump and muddied it with his phlegm. Others say that late one night, for a few minutes, all over the town of Ames, Iowa, the faucets ran yellow and as thick as melted wax, polluted by a terrorist, or maybe some parasite loosed from deep beneath the earth. And still others say, a featherless crow the size of a child tumbled down a chimney and onto a fire that charred it into a black pile of bones and sent a diseased cloud into the air all over town, one that people breathed into the pink pit of their lungs, where a burning sensation gave rise to a cough. That was how the sickness began, with a cough. A needling itch at the back of your throat that grew steadily worse until it felt like your chest was clogged with burrowing ants that you simply must expel, barking raggedly into your hands until they were spotted with blood. Accompanying this was a fever so powerful that a wet washcloth steamed when placed on your forehead, your brain cooked, your vision went red with twirling black flies along its edges. And all this time, you were coughing, until it felt as though your guts might uproot and push out your throat. One day, it was simply there, among the people of Ames, the virus rooting in their lungs like red-tipped mushrooms. The USDA labs were located there, level 4 security clearance, and host to every animal-borne pathogen in the world, from anthrax to bird flu to Ebola. And many speculated that it came from there, from an unwashed hand, or an open laboratory window or a pricked finger. The deadliest viruses must meet three criteria. They must spread swiftly by a cough, a kiss, a sneeze, a hand testing a melon at the supermarket, or gripping a pole in a subway car. They must be unfamiliar to humans so that antibodies cannot defend against them. And they must